Let me put it this way. That sort of love minus charity is love of self. And that's what we see in Don Armato, and that's what he could have become. The other side of what the young men doing, which is the pursuit of the intellect, is given to us in Holofernes. Oh, I love it. Being a professor, I love this. In which intellect, study, minus charity, is pedantry. And we get the other side of it in the other comic subplot, in which the old schoolmaster, pompous, full of himself, displaying his learning constantly to the point where nobody has any idea what he's saying. You can go through Holofernes' lines and they make sense, but you have to sit and study them. And Shakespeare's whole point is, if you have an actor on a stage speaking them, any ear that's hearing it is just going to say, this is a pompous old fool. This is a pedantic windbag, which is indeed what he is. Because the end of his learning is self-aggrandizement. The end of his learning is what the four young men are seeking at the beginning of the play: fame. As Don Armato in Love is saying, look at me, look at me. Whoever suffered for love as much as I am suffering from love. Holofernes is saying, look at me, look at me. Who was ever as bright, intellectual, and smart as I am? And in both cases, the love lacks charity and simply becomes selfishness. The intellect lacks charity and hence becomes pedantry. Not going forth. Not only no double power, but not a single power. Reduced to nothingness. Reduced to comedy. And that is the danger for these young men. Now, they learn this in one sense. By the end of the fourth act, they have this lesson. They have this lesson, and they do have the sense to realize the true nature of their oaths. It was a foolish oath. What they attempted to do was foolish. It will not work. Necessity, if you will, or love, or wisdom, which is in wisdom in those words spoken by Baron, because that is wisdom. Okay, who can separate love from charity? We have to go out there. This is, you know, it call it necessity, call it charity, call it whatever. There's a real world out there. We have to go out there, which means, and of course, this is a comedy. What it means is we have to go woo these ladies. This is what we have to do now. This is our obligation. All right, you know. But of course, what do? They go disguised. They go disguised. They cannot go as themselves because I would posit they don't yet have selves. They have been so busy, they have been so self-absorbed. The surest way of losing the self is to become self-absorbed. The self will vanish instantly. The only way of creating a real self is to give that self outward. And at that point, something real will be created. They have lost the self. So they mask themselves and they go as Muscovites. It's a ridiculous scene. But it's made more ridiculous by the fact that they go to woo, and the fact of the matter is they don't know the women they're wooing. If they do not know the self well enough to put that self forward and say, here I am, you know, take me if you want it, but this is what you're going to get. No, we'll be masked. And indeed, they all become one. They're indistinguishable. The love is indistinguishable. They don't yet know these ladies. Each one has made a connection, but the connection is through a trinket sent by the lover, not the woman herself. There is no love of the woman for who she is, her personality, what makes her special. No. I love her because she's a woman, and I send her that trinket. That came from me. What each of the young men is identifying is something from the self. I gave her that. That must be the woman I love. And they woo the wrong women. And the women are smart enough to do it, because what are they gaining? They're gaining power and control over the men. And pointing out to them how foolish they are, how green in love, not yet knowing anything about love or women or how to woo. And the men go into it thinking this is going to be a good joke, and once again what happens? The joke gets turned on them. The joke is turned on them. And instead, we have another lesson we have to learn. So they go, they think they're being clever, they think they're going to show what they can do, and instead, what do we get? They are ridiculous. They are silly. And they again have to ask for forgiveness from the ladies. They again have to apologize. And there's a sense of, okay, now maybe we can start. Okay? Maybe now we've come to the place where you have some sense who you are. Maybe now we can finally begin to do some real wooing, when in comes the pageant of the nine worthies. The lovers are no more like lovers. The intellectuals are no more like intellectuals than the worthies are like the nine worthies. What we are being shown is the great gap between what we try to present to the world and who we really are. And the fact that it's an uproariously funny scene. It is an uproariously funny scene. I won't go through it again, but I do want to make one point. They come out one at a time, and as foolish as they are, Costard is first as Pompey. Can't remember his lines. I, Pompey, am Pompey surnamed the Big, the Great. Oh, it is Great, sir. Yes, he just can't remember who he is. But notice, and this is wonderful, before he leaves the stage, he says, they say, great thanks, great Pompey, the princess says. Please notice that the ladies are very kind, gentle humor. They recognize the absurdity of what they're seeing. But the princess gives thanks, great Pompey. 'Tis not so much worth, but I hope I was perfect. I made a little fault in great. I blew my lines. I didn't. I only had a few lines, and I couldn't remember them. Okay. Then poor Sir Nathaniel comes out as Alexander. He remembers three of his lines, but that's it. And he just keeps repeating them over and over again until he's so struck with stage fright he can't even go on. It's just the poor man is frozen. The princess says, the conqueror is dismayed. Proceed, good Alexander. Again, what are we getting? Great kindness. Great generosity of spirit. He tries again. When in the world I lived, I was the world's commander. Okay. And then, and this is what begins, and it's happening all along, the young men mock, make fun, crack jokes. And the jokes are not gentle humor. The jokes are insulting. And the young men are showing that they can outsmart these guys. Well, it doesn't take much. Because admittedly, these poor fools putting on the pageant don't have much by the way of wit. Even the smartest of them, Holofernes, the great intellectual, who probably penned the little pageant, is showing the depth of his talent, which probably isn't even skin deep. And this is a glorious opportunity for what? For the young men and Boyette, who is a questionable figure. I'm not going to get into him. Interesting figure, but sort of the older guy who travels with the ladies and ugh. Again, let me just say maybe another image of what can happen with love that is directed inward. Okay, it's not a pleasant fellow, and some of his bawdy jokes with young women are inappropriate. He is not a pleasant character. The play is loaded with this misdirected love and self-conceit. It's everywhere in the play. In any case, he's cracking jokes. The young men are cracking jokes. And what are they doing? They're showing off. They are showing off. And they're showing off in front of the ladies. Okay? It's the equivalent of the young guy on the schoolyard who climbs up the tree and waves his arms to the little girl down below saying, look what I can do, look where I am, and then falls out on his head. It's old-fashioned showing off, but it is again showing off through words, through wit, and they are clever. They are much cleverer than these men who are putting on the little play. And finally, Holofernes comes out as Judas Maccabeus, and they destroy the man. They are brutal to him. They are brutal to him. And of course, pretend that he's representing Judas Iscariot. Okay? But in the midst of their joking, as the jokes are just ringing, okay? Judas was hanged on an elder. Holofernes says, I will not be put out of my countenance. I will get through this. You know, I'm not going to let your joking destroy me. Because thou hast no face. What is this? A citernet, the head of a bodkin, a death space in a ring. The carved bone face on a flask. We suddenly get death jokes. This old man isn't a hero. He looks like death. Ha ha ha. Not funny. And the joke is going to be silenced swiftly and severely in just a matter of minutes. But before that happens, and Shakespeare does something wonderful, the jokes continue. You have outfaced them all, and thou wert a lion, we would do so. Therefore, as he is an ass, let him go. And so adieu, sweet Jude. Nay, what? Why dost thou stay? For the latter end of his name. For the ass to the Jude, give it to him. Jude ass, away. And just as the young men are laughing full of themselves, we get this from Holofernes, who stops, looks at them, and says, this is not generous, not gentle, not humble. And the schoolmaster drops his pedantry. The language could not be simpler or clearer or more direct. And he teaches them a lesson. And it's a very simple lesson. There are times when you don't make fun of someone trying his best. And the old man is hurt. Only Shakespeare could create such a moment. And suddenly, of course, it turns on the audience. Yeah, I was laughing too. Yeah, I was having fun at his expense. Yes, I've laughed at him through the whole play because I thought I understood him. He's just a typical, stereotypical comic character. And suddenly what do we discover? There's a heart there. A heart that can be broken. Feelings that can be hurt. Shame on the young men and shame on all of us for laughing. And ooh, Shakespeare catches us. We have been lacking in love because we have lacked charity. Our motto comes out as Hector. Let me just say, before the princess says, alas, poor Maccabeus, how hath he been baited? She knows. She's well aware of it, and again tries to. Out comes Don Armado playing Hector, and the jokes continue. They have not learned the lesson. The jokes continue. Until finally Armado turns to them. Longaville, I must rather give it the rein, for it runs against Hector. Aye, and Hector's a greyhound. Armado says, the sweet war man is dead and rotten. Sweet chucks, beat not the bones of the buried. Honor the dead. They may not be honoring the dead in the best way possible, but they are sincerely trying to do a pageant representing some greatness from the past. It's inadequate. It's inadequate, but sweet chucks, beat not the bones of the buried. When he breathed, he was a man. Whew. Suddenly, the comic characters in the play are teaching the lessons to the young men who are so full of themselves. They have become so inflated. They now have broken their oaths. They're out in the world. They think they found their loves. They think everything's going their way. This is all going to, it's where just everything swell. And they're not going to learn these lessons, and therefore a tougher lesson has to be learned, and all of a sudden, in comes Monsieur Marcade. I am sorry, madam, for the news I bring is heavy in my tongue. The king, your father, the princess says, dead for my life. Even so, my tale is told. Baron says, worthies away. The scene begins to cloud. And suddenly this comedy that we thought would come to a comic ending cannot have a comic ending because these men are not yet worthy of the ladies. They have penance to do. They have a Lenten season to go through. For the reason we all go through Lent and all do penance, to learn hard lessons that we would not otherwise learn. The princess prepares to leave right away. She thanks the king, very kindly, gets ready to go, And then the men suddenly realize what they're about to lose. Suddenly we understand the title of the play. Love's Labor's Lost. Been through it all. Went through all of that emotional energy. All of that time. All of that experience. And now it could all be for nothing. And what they're seeking to do, what they hope to do, is hold on to something. The king says, I'm at line about 785. Now, at the latest minute of the hour, grant us your loves. It's an inappropriate request. Her father has just died. This is not the time to be talking of love. He still doesn't understand. And she says, a time methinks too short to make a world without end bargain in. No, we're going. You can't talk to us about love and marriage and the future now. There isn't time. They have been there for a long time, and during that time, the men fooled around. Now there is not time, because, and Shakespeare knows it, we live in a world of time, and time runs out. No, no, my lord, your grace is perjured much, full of dear guiltiness. Harsh. But notice, it may be guiltiness, but it's what? Dear guiltiness. I know who you are. I know what you've done. The affection is still there. And therefore this, if for my love, as there is no such cause, you will do aught, this shall you do for me. Your oath I will not trust. Whoa! Hoisting their own petard. There it is. Their foolishness. Their phony idealism. Their removal from real life. Is now going to cost them. It's coming too late. It's coming in a situation they never could have imagined, but there it is. It's going to cost them. Your oath I will not trust, but go with speed to some forlorn and naked hermitage, remote from all the pleasures of the world. There stay until the 12 celestial signs have brought about the annual reckoning. If this austere, insociable life change not your offer made in heat of blood, if frosts and fasts, hard lodging and thin weeds nip not the gaudy blossoms of your love, but that it bear this trial and last love, then at the expiration of the year, come challenge me, challenge by these deserts, and by these virgin palm, by this virgin palm now kissing thine, I will be thine. And till that instant, shut my woeful self up in a mourning house, raining the tears of lamentation for the remembrance of my father's death. If this thou do deny, let our hands part, neither entitled in the other's heart. Notice what's happening there and notice the language. What is she saying? You now go do what you played at doing at the beginning of the play. You have to do it for real now. You have to fast, you have to pray, you have to shut yourself away, but not for fame, not for self, but to prove you can love another human being. And out of respect for who I am and because I demanded of you. Meanwhile, she says, I will go and rain tears of lamentation for the remembrance of my father's death. Death bringing what? Not fancy plaques talking about how wonderful the dead man was, but the tears of those who loved him. The play ends in a real world of lived life, of real demands that will enforce charity, and real deaths where the bereaved weep. This is not the stuff of comedy. But in one sense, it is, because it is bringing us down to earth hard and with a bump, an unexpected one. Barone's punishment is even more severe. Whoa. Line 830. Now, we have to give him credit. He says to Rosaline, okay, what do I have to do to win your love? It's very clear. I got to do something. I'm not getting off scot-free. Make your demand of me. I'll show what I can do. Oft have I heard of you, my lord Barone, before I saw you, and the world's large tongue proclaims you for a man replete with mocks, full of comparisons and wounding flouts. We've just been witnessing that as he's attacked the poor players, which you on all estates will execute that lie within the mercy of your wit. You'll turn that wit and savage anybody. To weed this wormwood from your fruitful brain, notice, there's rotten, there are worms in the fruit of your brain, and we got to get them out of there for the brain to be fruitful again. It's a backhanded compliment. There's something there worth saving, but we've got to get the worms out of your brain. Okay. And therewithal to win me, if you please, without the which I am not to be won, you shall this 12-month term, from day to day, visit the speechless sick, and still converse with groaning wretches. And your task shall be, with all the fierce endeavor of your wit, to enforce the painted impotent to smile. Go to where the old and those who are in pain are dying, make them laugh. To move wild laughter in the throat of death? It cannot be. It is impossible. Mirth cannot move a soul in agony. Why, that's the way to choke a jibing spirit, she says, whose influence is begot of that loose grace which shallow laughing hearers give to fools. A jest's prosperity lies in the ear of him that hears it, never in the tongue of him that makes it. Which is why the jokes at the play weren't funny. They were hurting those who were listening to them. Then if sickly ears, deft with the clamors of their own dear groans, will hear your idle scorns, continue then, and I will have you in that fault withal. But if they will not, throw away that spirit, and I shall find you empty of that fault, right joyful of your reformation. A 12-month, well, befall what will befall, I'll just a 12-month in a hospital. He takes it on himself, okay. There's penance to be done. There is a Lenten time to come. And then another lovely moment, a lovely moment. Don Armado will marry Jacquinetta. He says, I have vowed Jacquinetta to hold the plow for her sweet love 3 year. The knight, the man of elegance and refinement and language, is going to become a farmer and farm the land for 3 years. This man who in the beginning of the play talked about over and over again the power of his sword is going to turn that sword into a plowshare. And the play ends with a real sense of peace coming, but peace coming the only way it can, through submission. Through submission. And a submission to something higher, a higher good, and that higher good based on a law of life, which is charity. Under which we must all work. Two little songs end the play. Again, a weakness last night. Beautiful settings, but you couldn't understand the words. Couldn't understand the words. Let me just end by reading through the very end of the play. Armada calls in the two singers. One side is winter, the other spring. What we get, curiously enough, and it's another little reminder of what the play has been there to teach us, spring sings first and is then followed by winter. Not the other way around, where we usually like to think of it, that winter yields to the spring, not in this play. The youthful greenness of spring was there first, and now the harsh, cold realities of winter have set in. We get the little song from spring, but spring, indeed, even then, is warning about the harsh realities of the real world out there. When daisies pied and violets blue and lady smocks all silver white and cuckoo buds of yellow hue do paint the meadows with delight, the cuckoo then on every tree mocks married men, for thus he sings, cuckoo, 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 a word of fear unpleasing to a married ear. When shepherds pipe on oaten straws and merry larks are ploughmen's clocks, when turtles tread and rooks and daws and maidens bleach their summer smocks, the cuckoo then on every tree mocks married men, for thus sings he, cuckoo, 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 a word of fear unpleasing to a married ear. Spring, what should be the happy time, as a reminder of sorrow and the tough realities of the world where a wife may betray her husband. The winter song is harsh, but filled with something positive. When icicles hang by the wall and Dick the Shepherd blows his nail, and Tom bears logs into the hall, and milk comes frozen home in pail. When blood is nipped and ways be foul, then nightly sings the staring owl, to wit, to who, a merry note, while greasy Joan doth keel the pot. When all aloud the wind doth blow, and coughing drowns the parson's saw, and birds sit brooding in the snow, and Marion's nose looks red and raw, when roasted crabs hiss in the bowl, then nightly sings the staring owl, to wit, to woo, a merry note, while greasy Joan doth keel the pot. And Don Armado ends the play, the words of Mercury are harsh after the songs of Apollo. Winter follows spring here, you that way, we this. The players are retiring back into the playhouse. You, those of us in the audience, are heading back into that real world where we must do penance and undergo the trials and deprivations of Lent so that a glorious Easter or a happy marriage, or, as Shakespeare recognized, the union of them both, the earth and heaven, in both of their glories, can eventually be ours. A couple of minutes if anybody has any questions. Yes?
Just on more of a technical note, with the play being written about the time that he was writing it in, is it dangerous, even was it dangerous for him at that time to make a comedy about human nature with the...
No, I think they were much more open to it then than we are now.
There's no writings as to how well it was received at the time.
It was very well received at the time. At the time, yeah. In fact, the reason for the revision was probably because it was revived as Christmas entertainment at court one year, which means probably the Queen requested to see it. And because they were going to perform it at the court at Christmas time as part of the Christmas festivities, I think he revised it and rewrote it. And then it was one of the first plays to appear in a little quarto edition. Somebody got a hold of the script and printed it privately in it. So it was quite popular in its own time. It wasn't until sort of after the closing of the theaters and the Puritan Revolution, when the theaters reopened, there was a whole new world of the stage, and this play didn't come back for many, many years, a long while. It's, as I said, it's been very popular in our own day. I've been lucky enough, and you know, I think I've seen 4 different productions of it, and I've never seen a bad one. It's a wonderful theater piece that works well. Interesting characters, good humor, and yet you'd think, given the language, it would be extraordinarily difficult. But the audience, I mean, we miss much, but there's still so much humanity in it that the play works well, works very well. Yeah.
You've probably been asked this 100 times, but did Shakespeare, when you sat down and said, I'm going to write this play, did he have this, all this plot, like love and the opposite of love? And
it's very tough for us to say. We don't know. The only thing we know about is his writing circumstances. Someone who once saw him writing made the comment that Master Shakespeare never blotted out a line, which means he didn't make corrections. He simply sat down and, to be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous for fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles. And by opposing it. It's hard to believe, which suggests to me a couple of things. Much of it had to be done instinctively, because he also was acting in the plays. He was part manager of the playhouse. You know, it was a busy, times were busy. He was turning out 3 of these a year, by the way. During his prime, he was turning out 3 a year. So we're in the realm of genius, which is simply a gift given by God. But clearly what he gave the man was a great mind and a great heart and an ability to express great truths. Shakespeare, it's what I say, Shakespeare could express the good, the true, and the beautiful better than almost anyone else. Now, how does an artist do that? We can't know. And I'm not sure he could have told us if I could bring him in and you ask him that question, I'm not sure he could have said it. Because when we enter the realm of genius, we've entered the realm of mystery and God's mysterious gifts to human beings. I would just say whatever the gifts were, he used them well. because he left a marvelous legacy. A marvelous legacy. There was another question somewhere else. Yeah, go on.
You're saying that this is sort of Shakespeare's way of saying that ideals which are not linked with reality usually lead you to reality the hard way.
Yes.
Does he ever write about ideals which lead you to reality like as in the case of Dante, Beatrice, and the unleavened to reality,
which
is always an ideal.
Yeah, the closest he comes to that are in the very last plays. I mean, the difference I make, and I think it's an important difference, I've said it before, that Dante is the great spiritual writer. He gives us that vision of the spiritual life. Shakespeare's the great secular writer. I mean, he's very much, the lessons have to do with living in a real world. His last plays touch on those higher mysteries, and I think begin leading somewhere else. But he had to go through a lot before he could write those. He had to work through the tragedies, which are the plays of doubt. And having worked through that, then came at the end of his career, I think, a vision of the ideal, and how it fully interconnects with reality, and not just in secular terms, but in terms of the human spirit as well. The last four plays that he wrote are all about providential design and trusting in God's providence. They're very mysterious plays. And they have characters in them who are idealistic but so real and human that you cannot separate the two. He had somehow seen that it was possible. There are probably more saintly characters in the last four plays than in almost all of the others put together. But it took him a long while before I think he could understand how it was possible. Yeah. That's, yes.
I've noticed that Domain and Longueville are not the main characters. Would that be the reason why they don't receive a harsh penance at the end?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. They're the tag-alongs. They're there to fill out the group, but there's also the sense anybody who comes up with the grand vision will be followed. And I find it's very interesting because it's the king's idea, and he's a magnificent character. I mean, he really is. He's got the followers, those who simply follow him and will believe in him because the voice is so strong, the vision is so overwhelming. Then you've got Barone, who's sort of providing the balance, but going, being pulled along, kicking, because his instincts tell him there's something not quite right here. But the other two fill up the stage, but they're very important, because you would not have the sense, I think, of the king, the intensity of the king's vision, if those two weren't there. They need to be there, but since they are the tag-alongs, they don't have to undergo anything nearly as difficult as the king and Barone do. Because Barone is guilty. He went along kicking and screaming when he went along. He knew better. From the first scene, his instincts are telling him otherwise. But he goes along anyway. He gets a very harsh penance put on him. But a necessary one. Because all the way through, he's saying the right things, but he's not doing them. He's one of those that up here, he knows it all. In terms of living it, he just can't do it. He just refuses to do it because he's too good at what he does. And he once his mouth gets going, he'll nail anyone. And we see him doing it. It's a lovely play. It's a lovely play. Although I must tell you, I'll just end with this. I had a student this week in my Shakespeare class who informed me that her own opinion was every bit as valuable as Shakespeare's. I will simply call her Miss A. She basically said, he wrote this stuff, and you're asserting that, you know, he's saying something that we should take note of. Why? My opinion's every bit as valuable as valuable as his. And I quite literally stopped the class and spent half an hour explaining to her why that wasn't the case. She was taken aback to discover that. I thought briefly what I would do is I would bring some of the remarkable opinions of Miss A with me tonight, and we do it instead of Love's Labor's Lost. But as I got her to admit, she has never written anything. So I'm not sure, you know, the opinions have not been set down. I couldn't get her to say what they were. But what's fascinating, because I was getting ready to, I was thinking about the play. I haven't been teaching it in class, but I've been, you know, been working on it the last few weeks, because it's not often I get to teach it. I love it, but I don't often get to teach it. The only times I have taught it in class has been when there's a production we could go and see. And, but I haven't had a chance, but it was exactly what's going on here. I mean, she is bright. She is clever. But my goodness, she thinks highly of herself. Placing herself on it, not real, bright-eyed, just stating, well, my opinion is every bit as valuable as Shakespeare's. I found myself playing the role of the Princess of France. Just put on. But I squashed her slowly into the ground. I hope with some charity, because that's what her head has been filled with. That's simply what she's been told. That's simply what she's been taught. And her saying that wasn't even an opinion. That was simply what had been put into her head. And she was not even aware of what she was saying at the time. But it's very sad, because that's what's being carried around there. And we indeed now live in a world that has no connection to reality at all. Totally removed. And every once in a while, there's a little gem like that to remind me of it. It's simply amazing. You are going out to live in a very real world. A very real world. You will find it out... more than anyone else. There will be a desire to flee from it. It is not a pleasant place to be. But it is a necessary place to be. And you must go with real charity. And that will double the power. That charity will double the power of the work you do. But It is not going to be easy out there. One needs to take some of this lightheartedness along, but again with the real recognition that the world needs penance. The world needs a Lenten season. It is very, very difficult to go through Lent. I'm in academia, I'm in a military school. When nobody recognizes it, acknowledges it at all, there is no sense of this is a communal effort. We know what we're doing. We're sharing something. There is none of it. And if you try in any way to hold to it, and occasionally these moments come when you have to say, well, no, you know, I'd really like to be there, but I can't. It's Lent, and it's like, you know, you've said you have three heads or something. It's just the reaction is, you know, why are you you're doing that? You know, it's very peculiar. It's very strange. But as a result, more necessary than ever. More necessary than ever. But it is. I will tell you, in all honesty, I've been teaching 26 years now. Every week becomes more difficult. I spend more and more time thinking about retirement. How soon can I get out? When can I turn and flee and run from this place? And then usually about once a week I have a class or bump into a student that reminds me, you know, I may not have any hair left at the end and I may not be standing, but I have to be there doing it. I mean, I have my little dream scenario, which is, you know, I come and I live near the seminary, and I get to come and talk to all of you, and I get to go to Mass every morning, and I'm near family, and I'm near my friends, and life is comfortable, and, you know, it's a dream scenario. And I spend, you know, more and more of my time just, you know. It gets woolier and cloudier and more detailed, but it's just bigger and bigger and more wonderful, And then suddenly, you know, I'll have a student who I can see in a class who suddenly something, for a moment, there's an instant of understanding. Or a student will show up at my door and ask a pointed question, and I realize something landed. And I realize it's all well and good to come here and talk to you. And I'd love to do it all the time, because for me, it would just be wonderful. But I had a student come back and visit. He looks about 15 years older. He's been out 4 years. He's on a ship in the Navy. He's married. He's got two kids. He's, you know, just... And he said to me, I want to thank you because I'm living my life, you know. He's growing old living his life. I'm growing old trying to teach that type, you know. And occasionally somebody hears it and starts living a Catholic life, and it's well worth it. But we all grow old in the process, old and worn out. It's an image His Excellency used in a letter some years ago, and I've always remembered it. It's my missal that I got about the time I became a Catholic, 17, 18 years ago now, is barely held together anymore. It's been with me to Brazil and France and California and all over, and I've traveled on Sundays, and it's seen more of the world than some people I know. And it's just, the thing is it's worn out. And there are days when I come to feel more and more like that missile. But I won't part with it. You know, I could get one of the new fancy ones, but I just won't, because somehow it's been with me through everything, and I know it's almost an extension of me, and there are days I know I look about the same way the missile looks. And it's because we've been through the wars together. And if you go through the wars together, especially in this day and age, they'll just wear you out. Just wear you out. You'll be holding yourself together in the same way and dragging yourself around just thinking, you know, I can't go through another day of this. And then you say your prayers and God sends the special grace and you get up the next morning and you go do it again. Because that's the real world with real people, and that's the only way real work can be done. And if we have real charity, then you just take a deep breath and, you know, I go in and I face the misses of this world. And try with charity to explain to her why what she's been told all this time is wrong, and that her opinion is not equal to Shakespeare's, and that she needs to read Shakespeare a little more seriously. It's more fun lecturing at the seminary. Thank you for letting me be here tonight.